Hey, evening, everybody. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours.
This is Josh Knapp.
Josh, thanks for joining me this evening, as always. Tonight, I have a pretty good topic that, Josh, you had come up with. I want to thank everybody for joining us. If you're joining us live, I appreciate it. Be sure to put something in the chat room. You can join over in the chat live. That's below description of the show on the Blog Talk Radio page. You can jump into the chat room and join us live there. And you can call us as well. You can call us live. It's toll-free. It's 877-217-3924. The only thing, I just want to mention one thing to the listeners before we get going, Josh. And this is something I know I have a product and service called TurboMedic that I've had for quite a while, and I've been actually adding some benefit to the membership there, and one of them is access to the Limit Creative web-based apps, which is a paramedic review app and a 12-lead challenge app. In addition to that, I've also just added the continuing education that's accredited through CenterLearn for premium members there as well. So that gives you another about over 200 accredited CMEs you can take online to help you with your research and stuff. So anyone listening that might be interested in that, to go check out the site at turbomedic.com and see what that's all about, and maybe you can take advantage of those benefits. And on top of the TurboMedic content, you'll get those and continuing ed credits along with those apps as well. So,
who's back in the credits, Jim? I remember talking to you about this.
CenterLearn is the one that I ended up deciding to go with.
Awesome.
And they have a pretty good platform there, and it's pretty streamlined, pretty user friendly. Again, they've got a very, very large selection of CMEs available. So,
BLS, and they're good for anywhere in the country. So any system that you work in, regardless of the state, their national registry.
Right. Have to, follow your state guidelines. Every state's a little bit different how much you can use as far as online credits. But you can... you can actually go ahead and check that out. But to me, the good part is with that is even if, let's say, you only need you can only use 24 credits online towards your recertification. You know what? It's such a broad selection of topics that you really can use it to help study for exams, to build your knowledge, to really feel comfortable in the job that you're doing as a paramedic. So I think it goes beyond just getting the continuing ed credit. You can actually use it for a lot more than that, and take advantage of all of the instruction there. 12 leads and learning how to do deal with certain types of patients and certain types of illnesses on top of that. So it's all great stuff. So again, I encourage people to go check that out. It's turbomedic.com. You can see what it's all about and get some of the details over there as well. And if you joined, say hi over in the forum over there as well. So, Josh, tonight, we're going to talk something about whose patient is it anyway. You came up with this topic. You want to real quick?
What I started with actually was, and you actually filled it out. I read the description you did for the blog posting, and you're absolutely right. Anybody can come in and change the dynamics when you're doing patient care, and you can look at that and say, well, a doc has shown up on the scene, and depending where you are and what your state or city protocols are, you might have to turn over patient care to that doc. You might have some intervention on your part that you can take, but you should be aware. I mean, there's also in some systems, because they're private based and they make their money on who they transport, there's sometimes a squabble over who got to the patient first versus who has ownership of the patient.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be a good topic to and I've been in those fights, locally with volunteers and such, and we got there first. Well, I was directed by the city.
Right.
And generally speaking, it's not a big deal. I mean, especially if you're a paid service versus a volunteer, you're paid every, hey, don't interrupt my dinner, you know, don't interrupt my lunch. Go ahead, take them, you know.
Yeah.
But there's times when, you know, that's not the case. So I figured it'd be a good
You know what?
Good thing.
Josh, I have I've got a couple calls on here, so let me bring them
awesome.
In and see what they what maybe one guy's been holding on for a little bit. Let me bring him in here and see what we got going on.
All right.
Hi, caller. You with Jim and Josh? Who is this? Hello.
Hello.
I had him on for too long, probably. Well, you can call back. I think Bob is with us, though. I
yeah,
believe
awesome.
You've...
Bob, hey, Bob.
Are you with us again? Are you Bob?
I am. Yes. Hello.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
All right. But Bob, what system do you work in again? Where are you at?
It's in Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay.
The county surrounding Wilmington, Delaware.
And do you have a lot of like interagency interactions there on calls where you've got volunteer or different levels of providers or anything like that?
Yes, we are an all ALS chase card service.
Oh, okay.
So every call we go on, we are riding on a different agency's ambulance.
Okay. So does that seem to have more of an issue with something like that, where you kind of decide whose call it is, or is it automatically ALS if you get there? Is that the way it works, or can you triage it down, or how does that normally work there?
We can. We're only dispatched to Charlie, Delta, and Echo calls unless an ambulance gets there and requests ALS.
Right, okay.
When we arrive...
For those that were not familiar with the level calls in your area, what's Charlie Deco, Charlie Echo Delta?
Those are calls.
Echo.
That's a
Delta
good question.
Echo.
it's a call that is a potential life-threatening emergency. Whether
okay,
it works
so,
or not is an entirely different. They only dispatch us the calls that they believe are potentially life-threatening emergencies.
So they talk like diff breather calls, chest pain, unconscious, stuff
yes.
like that?
Yes.
Okay. And I guess the same type of thing. With
level one, level two.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Same type of deal.
I guess we got that everywhere in the country. You know, they got to differentiate, you know,
sure.
the BS from the, you know, try to sort the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, although
I don't think it works very well. How does it work down there in Wilmington?
I don't think it does. I think it under triages a lot of calls because there are some
really
like syncope alert without a cardiac history would be BLS. A lot of seizures are BLS, and those seem to be the ones that are actually seizing when the ambulance gets there.
I find the opposite. I find that I seem to get calls get up triaged more. I find most of the calls that go out by me are they come in as ALS until proven otherwise type thing.
They do. Well, they do. That's a big issue too. But I think that's the thing that everybody complains about. But I do think that there's a lot of calls that get under triaged.
Where you think that you wait under triaged in the sense and I don't mean this to sound like under triaged in the sense that they should call for ALS first and don't?
Yes. But for the calls that don't, that they believe are an emergency that aren't an emergency, and for all the calls that they don't think are an emergency that end up being one, yeah, I think they'd just be better off if they sort of had an even response to everything. But that's just my opinion.
But yeah, I'm not.
I think there's a line there. I think if it seems pretty clear cut that it's going to be a BLS assignment, then that's one thing. But I mean, a seizure call or syncopal episode, I mean, things like that, I guess, should be probably dispatched to ALS out of the gate until you get evaluated or at least a respondent gets there and can make that decision what's happening.
Well,
right,
you know, like in New York, we have the differentiation between stat ep and a seizure. Seizures BLS, stat ep is ALS because, you know. But you want to know something? The crazy thing is that for the most part, and only for one or two times that I can think of in 10 years has it been, you know, I've gotten a stat ep and the person's still seizing when I get there. It's either that they're around the corner, I get it, and we're damn close, or there's something else, you know, going on, because most seizures stop, you know, after a little while. Now, do you need ALS when they start seizing again? Absolutely. But why is a seizure, then my question is, why is a seizure VLS and a stat app, you know, which is going to stop ALS?
I know, but where I am, a seizure is ALS, no matter what, if it's stat app or not. They had a seizure, it gets worked up because of the potential of it happening again.
You called for nonsense. You get called for nonsense.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. A lot of 5cc life, and I take them to the hospital type thing. You know. But I think, you know, talking about, like when it comes to deciding, though, I guess, whose patient it winds up being, you get on the scene. I mean, usually if it's just an ALS, I guess it's an ALS provider and a BS provider that's there. It's pretty, I guess, pretty easy to decide, you know, who winds up getting the call. The medical evaluator decide, you know, if it's ALS or BLS and triage it to the BLS if that's the case. But what if you get, you know, two different ALS agencies on scene, or you get first responders who try to, you know, say that what they think the patient is and make it to that it's an ALS patient. I mean, where is the, you know, how does that get decided on the scene? I think it kind of gets iffy, because you have that fine line of, well, okay, you have to be professional and you don't want to fight with another provider on the scene, especially in front of the patient, or have a disagreement where it looks like you guys are confused as to who the hell's taking the patient to the hospital.
Well, I definitely agree with that, but, you know, we have a pretty much, in New York, there's a pretty well-defined hierarchy. What scares the crap out of me, honestly, is when you get a doctor on the scene who's completely, and what doctors aren't. I mean, you know, I have, to my physician friends who might actually hear this call, there's, you know, no disrespect intended or to the regional REMAC docs that, you know, will answer the call. Those are the guys that know. But the majority of the docs out there that, you know, do care, you know, do whatever, either specialty care or, you know, they're just general practitioners, they don't know what EMS does. I mean, we're a meat wagon, you know.
Well, how many times,
call them up.
Yeah, I mean, how many times do you go to the doctor's office for patients?
I mean, all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
but you get
now that
doctor who's trying to, you know, kind of, I guess, dictate, you know, where the patient's going, the type of care they're getting, things like that. And I mean, you can have people who just, you know, I mean, I can see people, and I've seen it before in forums and stuff like that. When I've seen this topic come up, where, well, it's my, they call me, it's my patient, that's it. And, you know, that's kind of a cut and dry way to look at it. But when you're on the scene of a call like that, it's not as cut and dry. I think there's a
and it doesn't work
attack,
that way,
right? And there's a certain attack that has to get that goes gets involved with, you know, speaking to doctors like that and to getting your point across on how it is. I mean, Bob, do you have a policy in Delaware when dealing with, like, doctors that try to intervene in care or anything?
Yes, we do. If there's a doctor on scene, if they dictate anything that happens, they have to agree to ride to the hospital and assume all responsibility for the patient. That's actually in our protocols.
Now, how do you enforce that?
It's never been an issue that a doctor's been on scene. Now, at doctor's offices and a lot of the urgent care centers that we go to, occasionally it becomes an issue, but the way I've handled it and the way it usually gets handled is you just say, okay, doctor, whatever, and we get them out to the ambulance, and then we just treat them as any other patient.
Yeah. A lot of times that's a lot of time, I guess, better way to deal with it is just to kind of, you know, more or less yes them to death, and then when you get out to the ambulance, you know, do what you have to do, you know, according to your guidelines and the hospitals that you're going to and things like that. I mean, I actually have a sort of an issue where I have one urgent care type thing where the doctor is actually a REMAC doc in a different area, and he wants us to abide by those guidelines and listen to him as far as that treatment, but he's not a doctor that's you know, credentialed in my REMAC area, and it starts to be sort of a sort of like a a little bit of a confusion on scene when we get there because he wants certain treatment done, or he wants to give us, he kind of wants us to give us, you know, he's ready to give us medical control orders for drugs, you know what I mean, that he can't really give us because, one, he's not at the hospital to do it, and he's also not credentialed in our region. And then on top of that, he likes to try to transport patients to the hospitals that are in his region that, you know, that I guess he feels are better equipped to deal with the patients that he's seeing. So that always winds up being a problem. And that seems to be, from what I've noticed, kind of escalating lately to the point where now if I get a situation like that, I just call my med control doc and say, here you go, talk to this doctor. And you guys can
just out of curiosity, how far is the where he wants to go out of area?
Well, where he wants to go,
it's not like he wants to go to New York City from where.
No,
you
but
are.
It's about, I'd say it's probably about an hour away, 45 minutes to an hour.
That's significant. Yeah, that's what. How is that the best interest of the patient?
Well, because I guess where his hospitals are, they're more of the.
God, it's great for billing.
Well, they're more, you know, that too, I guess, but they're more of the trauma center, STEMI type. Hospitals type thing, which in essence, for certain patients that we get, when we have that situation where it's a trauma or a STEMI or you know, a potential STEMI, then we're going to go to those hospitals anyway, but we still can't take orders from him. We have to call our doc and get approval to go to that STEMI facility and get orders, you know, for med control, you know, drugs and stuff like that, and things that we might need. But it just sort of like kind of puts you off when you walk the door and the doctor right away is telling you where you should be going and what you should be giving and things like that. And, you know, you didn't even get a chance to even, you know, assess patient yet or anything. So
now what do you do now? And this goes out to you, Bob, as well. I mean, because I recently had a run in with a doc and it was very disconcerting because I'm generally a very nice guy, very professional. I'm very courteous. And when, you know, when you have a doctor on scene, I mean, about the only time that I can think of that I basically slammed the door in the doc's face was we were working up a respiratory arrest that turned into a cardiac arrest from an optometrist. And he opened back the bus doors and he goes, I'm a doctor. And my partner and I look, good for you. And my partner closes the door and locks it as we're working this lady up. And, you know, it's like, give me something that's useful. But where I was with the question for you guys is I was in a situation fairly straightforward, working a chest pain in a fairly a good story, meaning that she had the possibility of ruling in. Young woman in her late 30s, but ruling in as a chest pain, had early history, was diabetic, hypertensive, you know, all the good things that, you know, this could be a young MI on your hands. And the doctor is sitting there throwing nitro into her before, you know, we're able to even assess what's going on, you know, and if she had an inferior wall or anything like that that, you know, it could crash her blood pressure. I don't even have a line set up. And I usually, you know, I usually, if it's chest pain, I'll usually go O2, aspirin, and a nitro, and then I'll start a line, assess the blood pressure, and get that way. But I generally won't give a nitro, you know, unless the person is – I meant assess the blood pressure, then give the nitro. But I because I've been in that situation where a person's had a nitro and all of a sudden all their veins disappear. They have no blood pressure. Their veins disappear. I have no way to start a line. And so this guy is treating this patient, and I'm going, Doc, wait, hold it, stop. And he looks at me, turns to me, and starts yelling at me, who's the doctor in here? How dare you tell me what to do? You know, last time I checked, you called for an ambulance. I'm sorry, you know, before you start treating the patient, maybe you want to know what's going on. But what do you guys do? Because this was, you know, this actually turned into a kind of big deal on scene. And, you know, I thought I did everything right, and later on I know I did everything right, but you have a doctor aggressively treating your patient with drugs, and you're not able to do what you know is right and the proper procedures for a workup. What do you do?
Well, I usually interrupt and start firing questions. what's their EKG look like? What was their blood pressure?
Yeah, try to distract
those
them.
Those sorts of things. And then that's distract them. And then while they're being distracted, oh, by the way, we're just going to move you over into the stretcher while we're talking. And then
yeah.
Everyone's hands are sort of tied up with that. And then, oh, okay, don't worry, I'll get the nitro and the ambulance. We're just going to get moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's kind of a sticky situation because, you know, it's they're in the doctor's office. It's still kind of, you know, the doctor's patient. They're not on your stretcher yet or anything. And I think probably, you know, asking questions is probably your better bet than trying to intercede in what they're doing, unless you think it's going to, you know, kill the person right off the bat. But I hate when you go to doctor's offices and when they call for patients like that and they've done nothing. And the patient's like, you know, just sitting there, and they've done nothing. They're so concerned about the chest pain, or so concerned about
crap. I'm used to that.
And they've done
nothing
for the patient, you know. Well, here it is.
You know, an anesthetic.
Have you given any aspirin? Did you give a no? I haven't done anything yet.
Right.
You're like, this is the doctor's office, right? And
right.
You know, yeah. Of course, I'm going to transport him to the hospital, and I'm going to do what I have to do, you know, on the way there. But I'm not going to. You know, I kind of expect to have something done before I get, you know. They're on nasal cannula, and then that's probably the most you can kind of hope for.
Hey, you know, that's something better. You know, how many times you walked into a doctor's office for an asthma and they haven't had a treatment?
Yeah.
You know, I can take when they're on their third neb, you know, or even their first neb, because you arrive pretty quick. But, you know, when they haven't done anything, it's like, what do you want to do, package them up for me to intubate? I mean,
but I think you go back to what you said earlier, that a lot of times they've – and I think this goes back to what we've talked about before on the show, about how a lot of the public out there and doctors that aren't ER doctors being part of that public, they don't really understand what we do and what we're capable of doing with kind of just a taxi cab with a meat wagon.
You know, and I'll be honest. I've heard that, you know, what you guys said before, what Bob said, that, you know, I used to try to distract them with questions. That's 100% on, and that works, I would say, 95%, 96% of the time. And then you get that other 4% or 5% where the doctors are just like, you know, all you are wheels, and they've got to do pre-treatment before the patient leaves, but there's no consideration of what the hell they're doing that's going to have. It's like a Hail Mary pass. Well, if I throw some nitro in them and rush them to the hospital fast enough, maybe they can stabilize them at the hospital instead of, actually either doing something. Or, hey, how about that Hippocratic Oath where they pledge to do no harm? I mean, these Hail Mary passes are what really get me. I mean, it's what the hell are you doing?
But I think you get that. I mean, like you said, you're going to have, I think, in any situation that we deal with out there, you've got the ones that are the norm, maybe a little bit outside the box with things. But then you get the situations that are a little more difficult to handle, and that's when I think you have to really kind of pull your resources and think what's going to be best for the patient and what's going to be best for you in the long run. And, you know, it might be just, okay, we're going to get him on the stretcher and just get him out of this office before any more harm gets done type of a thing.
Right.
You know, and instead of arguing and kind of prolonging your scene time and what else can that person do with a doctor or a nurse or whatever, you know, getting them on the stretcher and getting them in the ambulance and then following your protocols and, you know, assessing the patient and doing what, you know, what the patient really needs, you know, based on what you find. You know.
And it's a situation we're faced with often. You know, it's that active diplomacy. When do you turn it on? When do you get into gear? You know, what should you be doing in the same time? You know, it's a little bit of, you know, you don't see the hand behind my back, so what's going on? We're moving the patient to my stretcher. We're moving the patient out the doors, but you're distracted with the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, we get issues too, I think, with the diplomacy end of it, where, and that's with anything, I think, I find myself being sometimes more diplomatic in the more stressful situation, not as diplomatic in the lesser stressful situations or in the more common situations, I might find myself a little bit more impatient with people, you know, because I kind of expect them to know what the deal is, you know. And this goes, and again, you know what, this isn't just doctors either. When we talk about dealing with other people, you think about even like volunteers that you respond to who might call ALS for chest pain, and then you get there and you assess the patient, and then you decide that it's not an ALS patient. They look at you like you have 10 head while the patient's having chest pain. Do something. Do something, paramedic. You know?
Right. Wave your magic wand.
Right.
I mean, you know, bringing out the dead, you know.
And then how many times do those volunteers or those first responders maybe, you know, complain later on that, well, I called your paramedics for chest pain or for difficulty breathing, and they got there and assessed the patient and then said, no, it's not an ALS patient, and it's BLS, you can take him to the hospital.
But you got to remember, you know, and you got to take this in context, and this is part of the diplomacy on the scene. The people, what?
I thought I lost you for a second.
Oh, okay, am I still here?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay, so this is part of the diplomacy on the scene, you know, that we all have to keep in mind, that the people on the scene that are trying to help are doing things, hopefully, and, you know, take the quotation, hopefully, there, within the scope of their training and ability. Now, how many times as a paramedic you have taken the non-rebreather with 100% O2 off the patient so you can get a room air sat? Because that's going to tell you a little bit of what's going on. Yes, you're discontinuing this this treatment that may or may not be beneficial because, you know, there's more facts coming out that saying, you know, supplemental
oxygen.
Right. You know, it's still part of our protocol, and you're not discontinuing it. You're just stopping it so you can assess the patient. And I've had BLS say, you know, got to understand from the BLS point of view, my God, you're discontinuing high con oxygen. You might as well, you know, cut their throat. You might as well, you know, put a plastic bag over their head. They're going to suffocate.
But then I get to the point where, you know what, if I'm the paramedic and I'm the high medical authority, let's say on the scene, you call me as the BLS provider or the first responder or whatever it could be. You know, if I'm doing something, it's because it's based on my training. It's based on how I'm trying to assess this patient. You know, I don't want you second guessing me on the scene and, you know, causing an issue in front of the patient or questioning what I'm doing in front of the patient. If you want to question me after the fact and you want to discuss things as to why I did something or didn't do something, that's all fine, because it's kind of a learning opportunity for that person. You know, I want to get in the issue of somebody trying to dictate patient care or question patient care when they're not in charge of that patient.
Yeah, well, more so, I think that you grow exception to when people question what you're doing, especially when, you know, somebody from a lower medical authority or less training questions what you're doing. And I'm of the mindset of, you know, well, hey, listen, it's okay to question me, like you said, afterwards, after the fact.
Sure.
But, you know, just keep in mind what the protocols are. And even though your protocol says, and I'm using high con oxygen as an example, but even though your protocol says high con oxygen, my protocol says that, but I need to my protocol also says to do an assessment of, you know, where certain things are working out. And so I may withhold that for a few minutes so I can better assess the patient and give a better story, because what's going to be important to the ER docs is not necessarily that they're satting at 100% or 98% on a non-rebreather, but what were they sat when you found them in their home. And that's an important piece of information that they're going to use for their medical evaluation. So, you know, like, I get that. But at the same time, you know, when we're going back to our diplomacy thing, we have to understand that they're not always going to be as confident or as well rehearsed as we are. And also, I mean, hey, Bob, when, you know, do you have EMTs out down there who, like, think that, you know, they know more than the medics do?
Sure, yes.
And And what do you, how do you handle those guys?
Well, where I am, I'm fortunate in that the paramedics are the paramedics, and we all work for one organization. And it is established that when we are on scenes, we are the ones in charge, and we're the ones responsible. And when the EMTs write their report, they will say, right, what they did up until we got there, and then turned over to medics. So on scenes, they may question some things, but first of all, this is a big problem for EMS. I mean, as a profession, we have a lot of people out there that don't know what they're doing, and we allow that to continue. And if you just go through and treat the EMTs and the first responders, with respect, the way that we like to be treated by physicians and nurses in the hospital, that usually you don't have a problem. Now, there are some paramedics who the EMTs hate that they will cancel just because they don't want to deal with, which is a bad thing. And I'll say things like, okay, if I arrive on the scene of a chest pain patient, I will say, I'll ask the EMT what blood pressure they got, and I'll look at the patient and say, okay, I am just going to check your blood pressure again, even though I probably don't trust the EMT's blood pressure. I am going to check it again just to see if it's different. And or if
Right.
they're on a
But that's
non-rebreather, I'll
diplomacy.
say, and if they're on a non-rebreather, I'll just say, we'll just take you off this. Now that they've had you on oxygen for a little while, we want to see how you do without it. And they don't really, the ones in my area don't really question those types of things if if you're nice to them. And but there's a whole art to the diplomacy between the different responding agencies. And where I used to work for a private service, I mean, really, their whole business model depended on appeasing volunteer fire departments. I mean, the two golden rules were you didn't piss off the hospital because that's where the transfer contracts were, and if you pissed off the volunteers, they would go with the other company. And that was really it. Where I'm now, that really it's not as much like that. But in other areas, it is, and you can have incompetent volunteers that are politically connected, and they're the ones that control the contract, and really they're the ones that have the power over your employer.
You were talking about that, Jim, in New Jersey when you were doing a cycle through
Yeah.
through MMA there. You
Well,
had that.
there were some agencies that would, and you and the I always find, and I even find it now as well, you have certain volunteer agencies or certain first responder type agencies that will that look to try to get the paramedics in trouble, look to try to second guess everything that gets done. And you wind up, you've got paramedics that'll just go ahead and make it an ALS call and just transport the patient to avoid any type of issue. They'll go ahead and put them on the monitor, just drop a line, take them to the hospital, and kind of just stare at them in the back of the ambulance because they don't want to deal with getting cold on the carpet.
If
You know?
an EMT, if an ambulance requests me, that's what I do. I will not release. Very rare, not never, but
Well,
very
I think if they
rarely would I ever
request
release
you,
a
yeah, I
patient.
mean, if they request you, I think for the most part, at that point, I think the call's already been probably evolving for a while. They've been on scene. They've already did, some basic vital signs and things like that. So probably for those type of situations, you're going to end up going anyway because, by the time you get done, you could already be, pretty much halfway to the hospital. Because do you do a lot of intercepts there? Will you intercept those types of calls?
And the other side, it's the same paperwork, whether
Yeah.
we write or not,
Right.
and then they're just going to send us in another call. So in some ways it's easier on my part just to write in, because if you sit there on especially on the side of the road, and some people do this. Both I know paramedics in New Jersey, and I know there's similar systems in Pennsylvania and around Delaware that will release a patient on the side of the road down the block from the hospital just to prove a point to the EMT.
Yeah.
And then you have a target on you. They're going to be looking for you to make a mistake, and they're going to magnify every thing. And to me, it's just the path of least resistance for everybody, including the patient, is just, okay, let's just take a ride to the hospital.
Right.
See, that's sort of the problem with what, you know, with the unequal systems. And I say unequal not in the sense of EMT and paramedic. I say it in terms of paid and volunteer. And, you know, again, before Jim gets all these texts and stuff like that about this, I'm a volunteer. I volunteer. I also work in a paid service. That's how I earn my living as a paramedic. But with that said, there are two different ways of looking at it. You know, volunteers, you know, what do you need to be a volunteer? You need a little bit greater interest, a little greater enthusiasm, a little bit more buffiness, if you want to call it that. But you got to, you know, you really want to be there. You're doing the best good, you know, to make a difference. And, you know, nobody goes into this profession for the great pay and the accolades that we all get, you know. But day after day, you know, there's a certain amount of it that becomes a job and a certain amount of it that becomes a grind. And, you know, when you're working in a system that is all paid, you get the EMTs and the medics, and they're all on the same page. And it's like, who wants this? How many times have I had this conversation? And Jim, when you worked here or you work with another paid EMT service, how many times you had this conversation? You guys want this, or do you want me to take it? When do you get off? How
right.
often does that question come up in deciding who takes patient care? You know, when do you get off?
Well, especially if it's a borderline type of a patient where it's not really clear cut that it's
a paramedic. Oh, come on! Even if it's total
patient.
Bullshit. If it's total bullshit that I'm getting off in 20 minutes, yeah, I'll take him to the hospital.
You know? Oh, yeah.
In fact, I would be looked at by, you know, some supervisors.
Because you've got to do the paperwork anyway to release the patient, so.
Right, right. Well, you got to do that, but it's not the same as, you know, releasing the patient, getting, you know, 94, which is transferred to a different level of medical or just canceled outright, and then getting a job 5 minutes to the end of your shift.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's be practical here, or let's be real. I mean, I'm not going to hold that, you know. Hold any bullshit back here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it boils down to what system you work in. I mean, everything, I guess, is a little bit different. I mean, where I am, I have no volunteers. There's no volunteers that I deal with now. Unless it's fire. Fire department volunteers are the only thing I deal with.
Right.
When I was in Jersey, I dealt with a lot of, you know, volunteer type thing. And then city, of course, there's not, except for the hot oil trucks and the, you know, the local volleys that might be like yours at Central Park or something like that might show up on the scene. So it's a little bit different. But, it gets to the point, I think, where, you know, as the higher medical authority on the scene, you get to the scene that you have to be the one that decides, you know, how the patient's being treated and where they're being transported to. Because if something goes wrong in the end, you're the one that's going to be looked to as to why something happened or didn't happen. You know, they were volunteers, or well, it was this, or well, it was, you know, it's going to be in the end, your assessment and your documentation and your decisions are going to, you know, decide what happened if something, you know, goes wrong or if there is a complaint, you know.
Yeah, but Jim, come on. I mean, everything, and if it wasn't clear, everything I said was not like, oh, it's end of shift and the patient's sitting there with, you know, 5 out of 10 chest pain and you're handing it back over to the BLS. You have to, you know, we're still medically responsible for that person. And this is something people have to understand, that even with an RMA, you know, if you're listening to this and you RMA people, and I RMA people, but understand, you're RMAing somebody, you are still responsible for that person's medical care, in the sense that if there was a reason that you RMA'd them and it turned out not to be the case, you really are on the hot seat, because then you've RMA'd somebody for, you know, for something that's not factual. I mean, you an RMA. I've long had this opinion. I've long made this comment that you have to be even more certain of your diagnosis, more documentation, and more concise in your documentation with an RMA than you do when you bring somebody just to the hospital.
Well, the funny thing about the system I work is paramedics really don't do very many refusals because we can release to BLS. The ambulance will cancel us sometimes or because if they, for whatever reason, the patient's going to refuse, they will cancel us because if we get there and the person is on the fence about whether or not they want to go to the hospital, we'll just release them to the ambulance. Now, Skip Kirkwood wrote something on somewhere that I read that I don't always follow, but is a good rule to live by, is that when you're making a decision about what you're going to do with a patient, if you think about, you know, you're hungry and you have a meal waiting, or you're tired, or you're going to get out late, if any of those factors are going to impact a decision that you're about to make, you need to take a step back and reevaluate again. And
right.
That has gotten me out of trouble, where I have had, you know, I had plans for something to do after work and, you know, 15 minutes before the shift, and someone's on the fence about whether or not they want to go to the hospital or whether or not I should ride with them.
And you're tempted.
You're tempted.
You're tempted.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. But you got to step back and you... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the other thing is when I release someone to an ambulance, my reports are a lot longer because I have to make sure I cover every pertinent negative. And whereas if I just ride with them, I can just say we rode to the hospital and nothing happened.
Right,
or if I'm going to release someone...
Same thing with an RMA. You want them doing more than if you transported.
Yes.
Like you want to cover everything that you can possibly think of.
And Bob, that was exactly what I was saying before. I mean, when you RMA or when you release somebody, even to another service or to a lower level of medical care, you really have to be dead nuts on about why you did it, what the patient's condition was, why you felt they were stable enough to do this with, and you know, back up your decision because you know you don't know after that. That the patient, you know, walked five steps and, you know, was found unconscious or dead in their home or, you know, died en route with the other ambulance crew, you know, you're guaranteed you're going to be called to the carpet and say, well, why did you do that? Why did you take that risk?
And I know of people that got fired because had they just taken a ride with someone to the hospital, they didn't have to even do anything, but something happened after they left, and then they lied about it on their documentation, or they said they checked something that they ended up not checking, and they get fired for that. And it's
sure.
Like it's so much easier to just ride with someone to the hospital
and to do your job, right?
Right.
Exactly. I mean, I work with people who they hear a syncope episode come over, and they you know, right away they're anticipating getting an RMA because a lot of times you get those patients that don't want to go to the hospital. By the time you get there, now they're awake, they feel fine, you know, and they look at me like I'm crazy when I bring the monitor in and do an EKG on them. You know, they're like, why are you doing that? I'm like, well, because you don't know. Maybe they had an episode because some type of a cardiac event going on. Why not just go ahead and run a quick EKG and find out for sure before you let them stay home, before you accept the RMA? You know, do your assessment, do your job so that if, you know, we don't have crystal balls, we don't know for sure what's going to happen after we leave. They could, you know, like you said, they could walk down the street and end up, you know, dropping dead or having a repeat of what happened before you got there. So we don't have a crystal ball to see that. We can only base our decision on what we're looking at and what we're finding and the tools that we have available to us as far as diagnostically, you know, finger sticks and pulse oxes and all that good stuff. And, you know, so we have to, like you said, Josh, we have to be pretty much, you know, pretty confident in our skills and pretty confident in what we're looking at to decide to go ahead and accept that RMA, you know. But I think it comes down to, though, when you talk about dealing with other agencies, it's like if you do that and the other agency feels that patient should have went to the hospital, and then they start second guessing it and start trying to call your boss on it. You know, where is it now? You know, 1 minute if the patient's not good enough to be there, they want to turn it over to you. So they turn it over to you, and then you decide the patient doesn't want to go to the hospital, and you're going to go ahead and accept and, you know, respect that patient's wishes. But now that same person who called you to take responsibility, they want to take responsibility now and kind of, you know, try to get you in trouble for it.
Well, I work in the real world. But we are not trained in which patients, nothing about our assessment determines when people don't want to go to the hospital, especially at the BLS level. And those are usually the positions people are in where they're on the fence about whether or not they want to be transported or not. But our decision, we should have no say in their decision about whether they want to be transported or not. Like, you know, another thing, I think Skip Kirkwood wrote this too, is your phrasing. What hospital would you like to go to instead of would you like to go to the hospital?
Uh-huh.
And I do the same thing. And again, I have the, if it's something that is very low risk of being something serious, I have the option of releasing them to a BLS unit. But if someone's going to refuse, I do the same thing and I'll say, okay, normal vital signs, do not rule out a life-threatening condition, you know, understand that there could be a serious illness that could be better off if you was treated now. It's in your best interest to go to the hospital. And then I make sure, you know, is somebody going to be with them? And if they're with them, make sure you call us back if anything changes. I make sure they're not going to be driving or doing anything that's going to put someone else at risk. And, you know, even on calls where I know that this person is completely fine, I still do that just because...
Sure.
It's not worth the downside of something happening after we leave, you know, to them and to my career just isn't worth it.
Even if it's something that's totally not even related to why you were there, you know, to the perception of the people around that person, you know, well, the ambulance checked them out, you know.
Well, that's sort of in your paperwork, though. I mean, if you're leaving and suddenly if you came in and the person
I'm not saying, you know, I have the sniffles and then I get hit by a car. I mean, two different things, but, you know,
right.
Anything that's, you know, remotely similar and they tried to, you know,
but it was,
back,
a,
you know?
Yeah, like a thinkable episode and it everything seems like it was just a temporary episode. They need a ride to the ambulance. They're all stable. And then en route, they develop chest pain or go into some sort of arrhythmia, you know, and you're not there. You know, something that can be traced back to, well, you know, one of the cases, you didn't completely rule out what the cause of the syncope was, so why did you leave the patient?
Yeah.
When that happens, I say, you know, the best way you can handle that is to say, I screwed up. If you just come out and say it, that will get you in less trouble than if you, you know, explain, this is what I saw, yes, I forgot to ask that question, or yes, I didn't check this. And
or lie.
Sorry, it happened. When people get into the real trouble, and this is the only way I really see paramedics that actually get fired, is when they try to lie about something or try to get out of
fake documentation or something. Yeah. Or
you know what? This is almost a topic that's probably good for another episode, Jim. What do you think?
What, lying?
No, just you know, because I entered the world of EMS, it has always been drummed into me, just tell the truth. Whatever you do, even if you screw up, people screw up, tell the truth, you'll be okay. And that's not 100% the case. You know, there are times when people screw up, they tell the truth, and they say, well, you screwed up, you know, and this doctor wants you out, and you're going to get me anyway. And
that depends on the screw-up, though. I mean, you know, it's there's only a certain amount of,
tolerance, leeway you get.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certain amount of excuses for, you know, what you're doing. I mean, you're supposed to be a trained professional, so you can screw up on certain things, but I think some things are probably, you know, inexcusable, you know.
What, you can't intubate somebody through the ear canal?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's the line there of making a mistake, and the line, you know, of being incompetent and not being, you know, not really should be doing the job that you think you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really arguing against this point that much. Well, I'm being argumentative just for the sake of it. But it's just that here, always when I've heard it, and when Bob was sort of saying it before, it's like, as long as, you know, the guys who I've seen get in trouble or the guys who've lied or the guys who omitted or whatnot, and the best thing you can do when you make a mistake is to tell the truth. And I guess the open-ended question is it?
Well, how many of these situations do you find yourself in? And if you find yourself in one every week or a couple months or something like that, you know, maybe there is something to that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, yeah, I think everybody gets one or two free passes. And if, you know, a number of, like, patients that you release to VLS die on the way to the hospital, then you know, when they notice a pattern, maybe something should be done about that.
Right.
But you know, I think when they notice a pattern, there are other problems.
Well, I think the important thing, and this is something I think, we talk about, you know, who's going to be taking the patient, who's that patient want to on the call, and when it comes to paramedics making that decision, I don't know, I find that most paramedics take it along the way as Bob does, and I know that I do a lot of times too, where I'll just go ahead and I will be the one who will transport the patient, and I will be the one to evaluate. Even if I take the patient and I don't work it up and I just treat it as a BLS transport, I'll be the one in the back with the patient. I want to be in control. You know, I want to be the one.
Now the question is, okay,
the end.
Okay, because now you just said it. You want to be in control, and that's a fair statement. You know, I'm going to sort of pick apart a little bit on what Bob said before was, you know, sometimes I do it because it's just easier. And God bless you, Bob, I do the exact same thing. It's just easier.
I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, but is it, you know, is it now, are we lacking? Are we slacking on that? Are we doing something because it's just easier to go? Or do we really just, instead of the word, I'm going because it's just easier, I'm going because you want to know something? Not everything's 100% here. I'm here. This patient called for an ambulance. We're not exactly sure what's going on, but we have a pretty good idea. But in case the situation changes,
yeah, they're
I'm
go.
There.
Right. If they're going to go to the hospital, I might as well just go with them in the back of the ambulance because maybe something will evolve that I'm not seeing now. Maybe I didn't think of a question yet. I didn't ask a question that I should have asked yet. And, you know, I'll ask on the way to the hospital, you know, maybe during another, you know, further assessment or whatever, or the patient didn't remember it. And now they remember on the way to the hospital type thing. And it ends up where it's just easier because, you know, you can document appropriately according to what you did or didn't do rather than having somebody else try to document for what you did and didn't do and then having that spin on that where it looks like you are not doing your job.
Well, I think we should get away from the word easier. I say I really do because I think
but
that hurts us. Yeah, it is. In the long run, it's a hell of a lot easier than the complications that could arise and the backpedaling one would have to do to explain their way out of why they relinquished patient care. However, if we go with the tack that, hey, listen, I just wanted to be more thorough, or that, you know, wanted to continue the even though the patient didn't need all the things that I could possibly do for them, I wanted to be there in case they could, would be a better statement than to say it's easier. Because easier's connotation of, I'm lazy.
No, but I think it's...
I don't think anybody's being lazy here.
No, but I think what it is that it's not that you're being lazy or you're saying it's easier. You're doing it because, again, like you said, you're doing everything that you can, you know, for that patient because you're there to do it. You know, to me, I think this is not the right way to be doing things. I think the EMS system as a whole should be different. I mean, it should be operating different. There shouldn't be an issue of worrying about somebody trying to dime you out because you triaged it down to a lower level of care because that's what the patient needed. You know,
And
but we
the
end up, you know, doing this whole, you know, how many patients do you take to the
yeah.
hospital? You start an EKG and you give them, you know, 5 cc's of normal saline and a lock, and now you're at the hospital and your report's no different than it would be if you didn't do those interventions. You know, but you're doing them because it's part of a protocol and it's part of what's expected of you. You know, because you took it as a paramedic.
In the big picture, we're really talking about the difference between someone going to the hospital with being cared for by someone with 100 hours of training compared to 1,000 hours of training for 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
It's not that huge. I mean, for me to ride in with a patient with the transport times in my, you know, suburban area, it's just not that much different
Now,
than
Bob,
if.
do you find though that do you ever find that the first responders or the volunteers or whoever it is that's requesting you, that they kind of abuse the fact that they know that you're going to ride the patient in, and it's easier for them not to have that responsibility by just making an ALS call? Because I have that all the time. I've got EMTs who'll say the patient's on Coumadin and you have to make it ALS. Meanwhile, they're on Coumadin for a month, nothing's changed. You know, since they've been on it, I don't know why it matters now because I'm on scene, but, you know, they feel that that's an ALS patient, and they try to make
They're
it.
AFib. They have an irregular heartbeat.
You know.
Well, you know, when you took their medical history, were they AFib? You know, come
Right,
on.
exactly.
But they don't even teach PMTs what atrial fibrillation is, really.
Oh, no, they do. Yeah, they, I mean,
Well, it teaches them a regular heartbeat. That's all they have to know. I mean, you know, it's enough to them.
I'm very forgiving of EMTs requesting ALS because I've taught in the program that a lot of them go through, and they just don't cover the things that I understand, the things that I understand and would not be concerned about or don't think this is an emergency.
And
So
you know what, Bob?
I'm pretty.
That's a good point, though. I mean, it is a good point that we have to understand as paramedics that they don't have the same amount of training. They don't understand, I guess, as much as we do, or people even that are new to EMS who might not understand what you might understand being, you know, been out in the field longer, you've had more experience and whatnot. But for me, I make these judgments and I make these, you know, I'm not trying to say this is a blanket statement for everybody what I'm talking
And you're a
about.
judgmental SOB.
Yes, I
You know,
am.
we should bet.
But the
Okay.
thing is that when I
Oh,
do,
my.
I'm doing it under the assumption, I mean, I'm saying what I expect from somebody is what I know that they know. I'm not expecting them to know what I know and then make the decision based on that. I'm expecting them to, you know, act appropriately to what their training level is and not try to tell me what to be done because what they think should be done, you know, based on their training and taking into consideration the training that I have and the experience I have.
Fair enough.
You know what I mean? I mean,
Yes.
I get cops that call us for evaluations, and then when you look at the patient and nothing's wrong, the cop, well, he has to go to the hospital. The cop is telling me he has to go to the hospital, who has no medical training. You know,
I know you love that.
I've had cops tell patients, or not even patients, people who they call to get evaluated, will say to them, "Well, you're either going to go to the hospital or you're going to go to jail." You know what I mean? And what is it, if you know, you get into a car accident, and you're told that, what are you going to say? Well, put me in a ward. You know, I'll go to the hospital. You know, and whether that threat is valid or not, I have no idea. But you know. Why that should even be a factor. You know, it just, you know, it just kind of, I guess, confuses me and frustrates me when there are levels of training that are out there, and you know, people need, I think, the providers that are out there have to stay within the training that they have and not try to work, I guess, outside of that training. You know, especially when it comes to deciding patient transport, patient treatment, things like that. Listen, guys, we only have about maybe 30 seconds, so I guess we've got to end it there, I suppose. Bob, thanks for joining us again. I really appreciate it. You made some good points tonight.
Well, thanks for having me. I had a great time.
And your blog, again, it's EMS Patient Perspective, right? .com?
Yes. All right. Yeah, EMS Blogs Network.
All right, guys. Josh,
excellent.
Thank you as well. And
see you next week.
See you next week. Bob, you're, of course, welcome as always.
Okay, thank you.
All right, have a good night.
Thanks, you too.
All right, everybody, that's it for me and Josh. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to listen to the archives over at emsofficehours.com. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours, and as always, stay safe.